Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Fredrik Eriksson. I am one of the directors at eSife, and it's my pleasure today to host the event that we're going to have with Johan Norberg. Welcome to you, Johan, historian, broadcaster, author, colleague and friend. It's a great pleasure to have you here talking about your new book, which is called Open, The Story of Human Progress, which has very recently been published. And it is, I can say, a really great book. And I really urge each and every one of you to get a copy and read it. And not just that, but also to use it as the perfect Christmas gift for this year, when we're all going to hunker down on our own or with our families for Christmas. We need to have some uplifting reading about what open societies and an open psychological disposition actually do for us. So I really recommend this as a perfect Christmas gift. So Johan, welcome. Welcome to this event.
Thank you, Frederick. Great to be here.
Open, the story of human progress. If you were going to give me an elevator pitch or someone else an elevator pitch, what's the book about?
The book is about all those great things, institutions, science, technology, goods and services that we all love and treasure, and we now think are threatened by openness in different ways, trade, competition, migration, and so on. The book explains that all of these things came historically from openness in all these various ways. That's the elevator pitch. Even the elevator came from openness and various technologies combining into great elevators.
And I suppose a lot of people would readily go along sort of with that approach to history, in a sense. If we take sort of an Enlightenment view of history, and we start with, say, the late 17th century onwards, looking at different developments, especially in Europe, but also in other parts of the world, that helped to open up societies for contrarian thinking, for new technology, for new type of enterprises that were actually allowed to challenge status quo and challenge incumbents. What I find fascinating with your book is that you don't start there. You start much earlier in history, and you're making sort of a case for openness, which is much less sort of an Enlightenment case for openness. It's much more sort of an evolutionary perspective on our species, looking at what type of challenges, environments that have performed miracles on human beings. Sort of starting pre-Enlightenment, what took you into that type of history of openness?
Well, what got me there was really starting with a more Eurocentric Enlightenment story about the world. That's often how I've used to think about history. But when you start to read about other cultures and other eras, you notice that we've had many golden eras, many eras of efflorescence, rapid growth of scientific knowledge, technological innovation, and economic productivity. And we've had them in all cultures, in pagan societies, in the Muslim Abbasid Caliphate. We've had it in Confucian China, in Song China. We've had them basically everywhere. So it takes something else to explain it. It's not one particular idea or a particular group of people or institutions somewhere that got this going. There is something within us. Some sort of openness to these discoveries and innovations, that whenever there's a crack in the wall in some culture, at some point of time, we end up in those positive circles where we see more openness resulting in more progress, and that makes people more open to openness and to progress. So that's why I wanted to start very early. And actually, I really start from the beginning with the first Homo sapiens, the first archaeological findings some 300,000 years ago in Kenya. We can see that the tools that they had were made of obsidian volcanic glass. And that's important because you don't get volcanic glass anywhere. You can't dig it in your own ground wherever you stand. It came from a long way away. So even 300,000 years ago, there's some evidence among the first Homo sapiens that they had long-distance trade relationships, got their natural resources from 88 kilometers away. And that tells you something about that potential within us. And it only takes the right institutional setting to get it going anywhere.
So why are we Homo sapiens sitting here recording this interview? Why aren't we Neanderthals? What did the Neanderthals do wrong?
Yeah, they weren't so good at upholding these long-distance trade relationships. If you want the quick response, Homo sapiens were free traders to start with. The Neanderthals weren't. There is some proof of exchange among Neanderthals as well, but not the advanced division of labor that existed among humans. The remains of Neanderthal dwellings seems to suggest that people did everything everywhere in those dwellings in their primitive homes. Whereas among human beings, very early on, you can see a separation. You cook food here, you prepare tools here, and there seems to be a division of labor between the sexes, between people, between groups. So some people hunted and they probably got better when they had more experience in it. Some gathered, some cooked food, some prepared the tools and exchanged. So they created more value in the long run. Then in Neanderthals, they never really learned about comparative advantage. They hadn't read David Ricardo and they haven't... there might be something about the structure of the human brain compared to Neanderthals, but for some reason they didn't develop that kind of exchange. So it seems to have been fairly simple. At least it didn't take a long time for human beings to take over Europe once we got here.
But can we infer from that there is something in our sort of genetic or psychological disposition which makes us wired to appreciate the advantages that come from openness or open societies, basically that we have learned how to value the import of ideas or technologies or other goods? Is that sort of part of now human genetic setting that we can actually appreciate these things?
Yes. And it's, I mean, Homo sapiens, we've done it for 300,000 years, but we did it before. Our ancestors in prehistory, we had exchanges like this. And when you do that over a couple of hundred million years, it develops certain skills. And the better you are with them, the greater your chance of reproducing. So what made us special was that we combined at a certain point in history three different traits that are fairly unique to human beings, at least to this extent: our ability to communicate, our ability to cooperate, and our intelligence. And it seems like these three things reinforce one another. The more intelligence, then you can access more knowledge and data, and with communication you can share it with others and collaborate to hunt, to gather, to create more safety. And when you do that over a couple of million years, that does change you. And I guess the quickest way to look at how special human beings are, that's just to look ourselves in the mirror and to look at the white of our eyes. We have white sclera, and the other great apes and other mammals, they typically don't. And that tells you something interesting, because it tells you that human beings developed a skill, not really a skill, but a way of broadcasting our intentions to everybody else. A chimpanzee who sees a prey or a potential partner wants to hide it, or there's a biological programming, an evolutionary explanation that lets them hide it from the others because you can't see where they gaze. It's brown sclera in their eyes. At some point in time, there must have been a greater value to human beings to broadcast our attention to others, to see that, look, there's prey over there, let's collaborate, and then we can hunt in a better way, or there's a danger over there. It pays off if others could see that we were looking in that direction, because then they could help us to defeat that very thing. And that's really the starting point of our genetic free trading capabilities.
What do you mean when you say sort of that one of the strengths of Homo sapiens is our ability to cooperate? I suppose a lot of people would say, if you look at, especially if you take more of a a modern historical view of things that one of the great advantages of the past three, perhaps 400 years is that we have unleashed our animal spirits in the sense that we can compete, but do it in a civil, peaceful way. We can compete with ideas, compete with technology, compete with business enterprises, etc. Some would even go as far to say that that instinct, that animal instinct, is sort of it's an important sort of part of human being in how we ensure that we move forward as individuals and societies. But I gather from your book that you take a different view, and you have this fascinating section on this old economic concept about Homo economicus, the economic man, to use the modern expression for it, where people are assumed to operate on the pretty simplistic or sometimes even egotistical instincts, in the sense that we can only value what we appreciate ourselves, and we can only value it if we put it into monetary terms. But Homo economicus doesn't seem to be someone who lives among us. Is that right?
Yes, this comes as a surprise to lots of people who have explained that human nature is this greedy, cold-hearted, rationally calculating, and being both Marxists and business schools let us know that that's the case. But when you do play various economic games in different cultures, you know, games like the ultimatum game, for example, where you're supposed to, you get some cash and ask to give a proportion of it to an anonymous player. And you decide the share, but the other player decides whether or not to accept the offer. And if they don't, neither player gets any money at all. And if we were this angry, cold-hearted competitors, I would always take almost everything and give you just the tiniest bit, because I want everything, and you would, rationally speaking, accept that tiny bit, even if it's almost nothing. But that's not what happens when we play these games. In almost no cultures does that happen. On the contrary, we're fairly close to dividing this windfall 50-50 with the other person. And the interesting thing is that when the other person gets too little, they don't accept it. They punish the other player, even if it's at a cost to themselves. And this gets even more interesting. It depends then also the shares you are giving the other player. Your initial generosity, so to speak, depends fairly accurately to how much of a history, how much use you make of markets and market-based exchange in that society. If you don't have markets, if you don't regularly trade with strangers, you want it all. Then you're the greedy person. Whereas if you constantly do that, you want to be generous and initiate a generous play, and the other person then accepts generosity but wants to punish you if you don't. And that tells us something about how we develop our attitudes, our moral attitudes, and our generosity on markets. When we constantly negotiate, when we realize that others are not there to serve us, but they're potential partners, and they have a mind of their own, and they can walk away from any agreement. So free markets tend to, ironically, develop this sense of generosity, or at least taking other people into consideration. And this, again, is what I think sets human beings apart. You talked about competition. Well, every species is a competitor in a way. Chimpanzees compete with one another in a brutal manner. If there's prey somewhere, it's usually just one chimpanzee walking away with it all. And it might not be the one who got the prey initially. They just fight over it. What makes human beings unique is that we have a peaceful way of competing with one another. And that's just the other way of looking at collaboration. Competition is a peaceful way of collaborating with others, offering them something and offering them something better than they think that they could do with the money that they're willing to give up to buy those things from me. So that's why I think that collaboration is a more interesting explanation of what makes human beings and the market economy work.
So in other ways, if you want to look for Homo economicus, the economic man, we should actually look among apes. Is that the case?
That's right. The chimpanzees behave like Marxists think that human beings behave, and business schools.
Right, all right, very good. We go back and take the long historic view, Johan. So we've now sort of established that there is a genetic anthropological view that we can take on the evolution of human society and progress. But it hasn't exactly been a linear process in the sense that we constantly have been moving in one simple positive direction towards more progress, more openness to others. So what are sort of the interesting historical periods you think that we should learn a lot more from? Perhaps that rightly or wrongly aren't being viewed as interesting examples of what openness actually brings to humanity.
Because now it's a good thing you raised this, because we've talked now about the good part of history and of my book, but we are double natured. It's not just that we are open, we also have a tendency to be very closed minded. We do create progress, but sometimes we ruin it all. And so if the first common denominator between all these cultures that had golden eras was that they were, relatively speaking, open compared to the other cultures at the same time, but the other denominator is that they all ended at one point or another, except this one so far. We'll see. But that tells you something important about what we should be looking for as well. Not just lessons about what we did right, but also what we did wrong historically. But parts of human history that I think that we should focus on more, I think it's absolutely fascinating thinking about the experiment of having a Martian or an alien looking at planet Earth 1,000 years ago, trying to find out where is the Enlightenment going to come from, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the Industrial Revolution. And they would obviously not have picked Europe. Europe at that time so desperately poor that most of it wasn't even worth raiding for nomadic bandits at that time. They would go to the Abbasid Caliphate probably and look at how they were the true inheritors of the Greek early Enlightenment, learning from not just philosophy from Aristotle and others, but also astronomy, medicine, developing fairly advanced scientific skills and technological ones. Or the other place to go would be Song China. Song China at that time used a nautical compass to find its way around with enormous armadas. It fought with gunpowder and it printed books with a printing press. So the three inventions that Karl Marx, writing in the 1860s, thought were specific to the European bourgeoisie and unleashed capitalism over here. But you could see in Song China, because of a tradition then of openness, open exchange with others, picking the open migration, getting the best scientists and traders and priests from all over the world, or at least Asia, an openness to innovations and to surprises from various places, creating rapid economic growth, property rights for farmers that, according to some historians, created a bourgeoisie mindset of profit-making farmers who constantly developed and improved their land and the crops that they used. Something was going on there that, according to some historians, could have, had this been allowed to proceed peacefully, could have unleashed an industrial revolution some 500 years before it got started in Europe. So we should look at that, what made that possible, and obviously also what ended it.
Indeed. And if you look at, you know, the usual historical sweeps that you can find, perhaps not so much in books on economic history, but certainly in a book on general history, military history, for sure. I mean, some would certainly point, you know, to Rome as sort of one of the archetypes of being successful organization of society. They would point to military strength, the capacity to control a vast area land, point to at least some degree of curiosity about what happens in other parts of the world and to go there, sometimes for military domination purposes. How would you rate sort of Rome in your historical categorization, sort of with openness leading at some point towards non-openness or a closed society?
Well, I haven't quantified it, so there's no 1 to 10 list of how open it's been, but I would say that Rome, just like most of the long-lasting empires that we've seen, couldn't have made it without openness in a dramatic way. And by that, I don't mean sort of warm, fussy, bleeding heart liberalism, because they were vicious warlords and advocates of slavery on a massive scale. But they had what Montesquieu, the Enlightenment writer, pointed out was the key to success, was that whenever they met a subjected people, they abandoned their own ways when they found something better over there. If they had a better shield or a better weapon or a better way of a better parchment, they borrowed it. They stole it immediately, and that made it possible for them to continue to make progress. And obviously creating this Pax Romana then after a while, and having that openness where not just shipping but all roads led to Rome in that extent, meant that you could draw on the skills and on the ability and the technology of all different parts of the empire. And the perhaps the most important thing is then to get not to discriminate. And this is the lesson that we should all learn in this day and age of resurgent nativism, to not discriminate against others because they belong to another culture or ethnicity. If they were the best people, they could make a rapid career in the military and even make it all the way to becoming the emperor, as long as they sort of accepted Rome as the superior power and some of the cultural traits. Claudius famously pointed out that the Gauls are now okay because they do not longer wear trousers. So there was a limit to Roman tolerance against not wearing togas, at least. But then, just like in so many other society, there is what economic historians and technology historians talk about as Cardwell's law. There's always, when someone is successful, a lack of interest in new surprises and competitors coming from other places. So there's a certain segmentation, and where incumbents in politics, in business, in religion, in intellectual incumbents, they are not that keen on continued openness once they've got there. So we have this internal struggle within every culture, including the Roman one. And when you don't have more easy exploits, countries to invade and property to steal, you have to have that innovation coming from back home. And if you're not open to that innovation, you begin to collapse sooner or later.
Is that also the reason then why flourishing societies tend to not necessarily stop flourishing, but at least that they lose some of that appetite for progress, that they've already advanced to such a place where at least in relative terms they may be pretty dominating, and once they are, they're not interested in making new progress anymore? So is it sort of an inbuilt mechanism in our own success, that once we get there, we start to be interested in moving forward even more?
Yeah, I think so. The being happy and rich and content is the worst place to be, because then you only think about all the things you've got to lose. And you think that new surprises and openness to innovation might threaten what we already have. And it's easy then to move towards more closed-mindedness and more fear of what could happen. And we also see that in these cultures that we've seen historically that were the greatest powers on earth, how they, for various reasons, began to look inwards. Like the Abbasid Caliphate, a struggle between the forces of openness and closed-mindedness, where the closed ones won out. In China, after the Ming Empire and the Mongol period, we had the Ming Empire, the Ming Dynasty. They basically said that now it's stability that we want. We want to protect what we've got against others. So let's start trade wars with others and build a wall, basically. So it was China, Ming China first. And famously telling eventually, and this is a much, much later Chinese emperor, but to the British request for trade in the 18th century that, look, we don't have any need for you. We don't need Europe. We're top of the world. We're the best. So you can just go home. And that's, and in a way, he was right at that point, but it was spectacularly ill-timed because England and Europe was then rapidly starting the Industrial Revolution. So that place where we all would like to be happy and content is, I think, the most dangerous place to be.
It's a good sort of framework of thinking also, not just comparing societies, but also comparing, you know, different people and different ages. But coming back to openness then, and I take it sort of that we can't get a sort of foolproof scientific definition of what actually constitutes openness. But if you would give me sort of, you know, the most important elements of it, you know, from a historical point of view, what have constituted in societies that have been comparatively open and that have flourished? What has been the most important aspects of those societies?
I try to divide this in the book with, when I talk about particular institutions, I talk about open trade, exchange in various ways with others, goods, favors, knowledge, technology, goods and services, but also openness to people and the ability for people to move across city lines and nation borders and to move to where they can make most use of their brain power and their skills and therefore also to enrich those societies. I talk about open minds, freedom of speech in the broadest sense possible, so that different ideas and perspectives on the world constantly clash and inform one another. And open societies, in which constitutes lots of things. But I would say with Karl Popper that the open society is the society that's never finished. It's not created from a particular blueprint that tells you what it looks like. It's the society that's constantly a work in progress and open to surprises coming from all parts of society rather than from the top, from the Politburo or from Parliament, but from individuals and organizations and businesses who constantly come up with new ways of doing things. So that would be sort of the broadest possible summary of the institutions. And if I had to summarize it in one sentence, it's openness to surprises, to the kind of things that you didn't expect in society, in thought, in science, in the economy.
And I suppose then if you want to have an understanding of what the other alternative is, it's basically less openness to trade, less an openness to new ideas, less openness to new technology, less openness to new individuals, cultures, surprises. Also referenced this when we began this conversation that open societies, they can end because institutions change, because politics change. But these institutions also appeal to something deep within us, right? It's almost as if there is a psychological humanity that we, at least occasionally, will favor cultures or societies or environments where we close off the rest of the world.
Yes. So cooperation and exchange is not the full story. That's one part of it. But we are double-natured. We also tend to be, we can, we have a tendency to be very hostile to this openness. And I think that that's really two sides of the same coin. Because, you know, once we learn to cooperate in a splendid way, we could begin to encircle predators on the savannah and throw stones at the hyenas and the lions. Then suddenly we move to the top of the food chain. But when you're at the top of the food chain and feel that no other animal can ever threaten us again, you also have this slight worry that there is something that can threaten us, and that's other human beings who cooperate even better than we do to kill and steal us. So this created an arms race between different between human beings, basically. Those who cooperated the best were most successful, and they could push the others off. And this has created within us a constant and deep worry about what others are up to. Sometimes for good reasons, but often it's just a fear of other groups, of the other tribe. And because historically, when they were successful, when they became rich, when they developed new skills, that was a threat to us because it used to be fairly violent, our human prehistory. So we still have that. And that's one of the reasons why it's so easy to set group against group, because we have to be constantly worried about the others. It's also, even in peaceful cooperation, you know, if we cooperate, we create lots of value. So we have to be able to distinguish those of us who cooperate and the others who would just like to move in and exploit us and take the results of what we did. So in various ways, we constantly think about who we are and who the others are. And that changes constantly. It's fluid. The groups we belong to change constantly. But we have that tendency, and that can easily be exploited by demagogues, setting group against group, nation against nation. And whenever we feel this kind of hostility from another group or from another country, it's so very easy to become aggressive yourself and to get a spiral of closeness going instead. And you can see that in lots of different psychological experiments, how easy it is to start to get the little tribalist within us to take upper hand against the traitor within us. It's enough to put people into almost arbitrary groups, and then they start to be interested in benefiting their own group and to hurt the others. We talked about economic games before. Well, you can divide people into arbitrary groups, for example, according to what they think about two modern painters whom they've never seen before, a painting by Klee and a painting by Kandinsky. And then you end up in a Kandinsky group or a Klee group. You never get to meet the others. You've never met them before. They're complete strangers. But then when you're asked, so how do you divide the economic value between strangers that you will never meet, then you want to benefit those who have your own taste in art, and you want to punish the others. But it gets even worse. It's not just that we want to maximize our own gain or a stranger's gain if he has the same taste in art, but we want to make the difference between the groups as large as possible, between the Kandinsky group and the Klee group, even if our groups get less than we would otherwise. So when we're triggered to think about groups and tribes, then we're not interested in mutual gains, and we're not even interested in maximizing our own income. We want to make as much separation between ourselves and the other group as possible. And that's crazy in almost every way, apart from one. It made sense during the Stone Age, when the other groups potential progress could be a threat to ourselves. And that's probably what we still have there. There's an famous Eastern European story called Vladimir's Choice that points to this. When the poor peasant Vladimir, he gets an offer by God. God appears one day and says, look, it's your lucky day, so I will give you anything you ask. But there's a caveat. Whatever you get, Vladimir, I will give to your neighbor, Ivan, twice over. So it's a bad day for Vladimir because he doesn't want to benefit his neighbor. So he thinks and thinks, and then suddenly he comes up with a perfect plan. Now I know, God, please pick out one of my eyes, because then you have to pick up two of Vladimir's eyes. And obviously we don't do that as individuals. But when we think of ourselves as groups, as countries in competition with other groups and other countries, then we start to think in that way. And that's what ruins civilizations, because that cuts us off from their ideas and their skills and their economy.
So how would you classify our current civilization in the West on the basis of your historical take here? Are we sort of... Have we peaked and are now sort of moving away from progress, because all the things that you talked about, sort of our tribal instincts and our wanting to avoid that China to overtake us and become a lot more successful in scientific economic developments. Is that now leading us towards less flourishing in the West?
Yeah, I think we're up against some difficulties because, you know, we talked about that worried place to be, top of the world and worried about everything you can lose. I think that's where we are in the West right now. Used to thinking we're top of the world, worried about others making progress in other places. That's often what gets it started, this idea that perhaps you should pick one of your eyes to get the others to lose two eyes. So I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen this nativist populist backlash against globalization recently. But we also have a great legacy of our institutions, of openness in politics, in economics, and no matter how hard other countries try to imitate many of the results of those institutions, the economic progress, technology, and so on, it's more difficult to borrow that kind of institutional setting. So for a while yet, we have both those forces within our societies right now fighting out a fairly ugly battle. And the one thing we've got for us is that we have a great legacy. So let's hope we don't ruin it.
All right. I'm now going to allow a question from one of the participants, Oscar Guinea.
Thank you very much for the event. It was it's been really interesting. I just wanted to ask Johan about his take on China. It seems to, I know China has benefited massively from openness, but it seems that has been able to infuse in the last years, you know, the ability to progress technologically and at the same time to become closer politically and intervening more on the economy. I just wanted to get his thoughts about China and the outlook of China going forward.
That's a good question, and that's always the question in a way, because it has large impacts on what happens in the world, not just economically, but also intellectually, in which kind of model we prefer around the world. I'd say that China has prospered tremendously on openness, exactly as you pointed out. There's a tragic misreading among many outside China, but also by the Chinese Communist Party, that this was some sort of state-guided development creating this wealth. And that it has tragic implications if they take this seriously, which they seem to be doing right now and think that that's where progress is going to come from in the future. Because as has been pointed out by many who have studied the changes in China, and one of my favorite book is Ronald Coase's and Nina Wang's book, How China Became Capitalist. They explain that it came from the margins. It did not come from the center. It came from farmers in villages who secretly privatized their land to create more food safety. It came from village businesses and from young people in the villages who fought for informal businesses and the ability to start it on a larger scale to get employment. And it was eventually then, it came from free zones in various ways where businesses were allowed to avoid traditional communist restrictions on business, on foreign investments, and on trading with other places. So all these changes came from openness and from the opposite of what the Chinese Communist Party really wanted. The only thing that could be said for them is that they approved of it and gave it a stamp of approval afterwards when they saw that these things succeeded. Did not come from sort of the major state-owned companies or from the Politburo or anything like that. So what's going to happen now in the longer run? Well, I'd say it depends on whether it's the traditional open Chinese mindset or the closed one. The Song China and the Chinese entrepreneurs, or Ming China and Mao Zedong. and perhaps Xi Jinping, whether which one is going to get the upper hand in the longer run. It is possible to create some fairly impressive productivity gains and technological innovation as well, if you, within sectors where the government really wants to see particular results, if they know what they want and they can throw money at it and protection and easy access to finance and the best minds, that's possible even in a command and control system. But it's more difficult to get the surprises, the things that you didn't know that you wanted. And after you've run out of things to imitate from other parts of the world, it's only from the surprises that you can create the innovations of the future. And that's the very thing that it's so difficult for authoritarian systems to accept. So that's why we have yet to see. When I researched the book, I found such a great, I thought, a microcosm of what China is going through and these two different interpretations and ways forward. When I found in the same copy of The Economist magazine, two different sections, two diametrically opposite attitudes on what China is doing. One was from a US entrepreneur who said that China is fantastic. There are no permission requirements. They just want me to make progress in this area. So I want to invest there because China is the future. The other article was about an app company in China that had just had to apologize publicly for not developing and innovating according to socialist principles, because they had made innovations in an area that the Politburo wasn't very interested in. And those two different interpretations, they're both there because we have both things in China going on right now. It depends on which one gets the upper hand in the longer run, I'd say.
All right. Thank you very much, Johan. First question is, if the West is the place to be worried about, what societal and perhaps in particular institutional characteristics need to reinvent ourselves and to sustain success? And related to that is also a question around one perhaps of our historical and past successes. Following the Second World War and global institutions that help us to operate a lot more and a lot better than we did in the past. So is there a lesson for us now how we can revitalize our global institutions like the United Nations and the WTO?
Yeah, those, in a way, it's the same response to both of them. I think that what we need to reinvent, basically here, is some sense of, for the lack of a better word, adventure. And not just go looking for safety and protection. We've got this strong trend right now of defending what we've got, defend our old industries and our old ways of life. And that kind of defensive posture is the very thing that undermines societies traditionally. We need the openness to what's new and what's strange and what's crazy to get this going. And I happen to think here in Europe, the thing to really reinvent is the internal market of the European Union and make sure that it's not a way of standardizing solutions and of protecting particular economic models, but it's a way of having more of openness to strange inventions from strange places and to really fulfill the promise of the inner markets and of the four freedoms. Specifically when it comes to services, I think there's a lot that could be done to make sure that we get the ability to compete and collaborate to create wonders there. When it comes to global institutions, well, the problem is that it might be that they could only be created in such a tragic setting as the aftermath of the Second World War that created this sense of urgency from so many groups that it was okay to abandon some of your, some call it national sovereignty, I'd say to surrender some of your ability to hurt other countries and in the process hurting yourself as well. Perhaps that was only possible when you saw that the tragic results of going in the other direction dramatically. How do we reinvent it now in an era when there's, on the contrary, this demand for taking back all kinds of powers and authorities in the hands of local powers and national governments? That is difficult, and sometimes you have to stare into the abyss to see the alternative. What I do think might be the best result of these 4 years with Donald Trump is that we are beginning to see what might happen if it's a free for all and the idea of a dog-eat-dog world, where there's not mutual gain between countries, but rather it's eat or be eaten. That's the kind of thing that might focus minds and get us to go back to the drawing board and to give some of these institutions more bite, or at least being able to function.
All right, thank you very much. I'm now going to give the floor to Pablo Bresciani. Welcome to join us, Pablo.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for the word. Johan, my question is, how do you think it's going to affect this pandemic that is happening now in the world with this opening that you talk about in your book? No, it's a strange situation on the evolution of our humanity. Thank you.
That's a very important question. And obviously, it has unfortunately strengthened the case for closed, because in times, and we can see this historically, during many major disasters and threats, but specifically in pandemic threats, there is this tendency to think that we're creating safety by building walls and keeping outsiders out, because disease is always associated with the others, and there is this risk to global supply chains. You think you want to keep everything close to yourself instead. So I think it has strengthened some of these tendencies, perhaps not as much as I would have expected, and perhaps not as much as we've seen historically. And one reason could be, I think, that it was spectacularly bad timing for the right-wing populists, because had this pandemic come 4 years earlier, they would have been in opposition and they would have been in a great position to explain that, look, this is what globalized elites throw at us, this pandemic. Now we have to shut everything down and close the borders. This is what someone like Steve Bannon, who's a more historically minded nativist than some others, has said. We should have used this to talk about the threat to human lives and to get back more authoritarian governments to shut down societies, economies, and trade. But because of this timing issue, instead, some of these populists were in power. For example, Donald Trump in the US. And he just thought it was a threat to his re-election campaign and to Wall Street. So on the contrary, he downplayed it. And so it's created a very strange realignment politically on what to do about these things right now. But definitely the forces who say that the world is a dangerous place, obviously they have been strengthened by this. But at the same time, forces who say that we need openness, or that dependency makes us more dependence on other countries makes us more resilient in times of crisis, to quote a recent ESIP paper, they have also been strengthened. We have also been strengthened, because it was so easy just 1 year ago to dream about a world with less international trade, less mobility, less migration, fewer flights, no business travel. Wouldn't that be a nice world and better for the environment? Well, now the evidence is in. We shut down the world for 6 months, and the result is a global depression, and it's another between 85 to 110 million people who've been thrown into extreme poverty because of this experiment with deglobalization. So I think it has also been a real-life test of what a more closed world would look like. And I think some people are thrown off because of that and are not interested in pursuing it any further. So my conclusion is that both sides have been strengthened, both those who want less and those who want more of openness in the world. So we'll see a more fierce debate in the future.
All right, Johan. So may I follow up on that question on COVID and ask more of a historical question, which is, I suppose it's a question about flourishing societies that eventually start to stagnate and they fail. Your sort of explanation, which we discussed so far, which is very much so on the endogenous trend, which is that within societies, institutions decay, people start to lose their appetite for more progress, or they start to lose the curiosity about what improvements that could happen if we just allow people to pursue adventurous goals. Exogenous developments, like you have sort of a big meteoric development which just sort of knocks societies off their path. Pandemics, for instance, historically the of exogenous shock that can sort of destroy wise healthy society and open societies.
Good point. And I think they're completely interrelated, and it's difficult to see where one starts and where one ends when it comes to the factors that undermine openness. Because we have this internal struggle going on constantly between those who think that they benefit from openness and those who see themselves threatened. In certain periods, one or the other side gets the upper hand. And often that's because of external shocks. Often that's because of a particular threat. Could be a Great Depression. Could be a global depression, could be a major natural disaster or a foreign threat of invasion or a pandemic, things that throws everything overboard. It doesn't have to be too dramatic in the long run for those institutions. We've seen that historically as well. Song China was invaded by the Mongols, but when the Mongols noticed that, look, they're richer than us, they have better, higher state of science, culture, technology, and so on. They abandoned their ideas of just using China as grassland for their horses to feed themselves. And instead, they decided to uphold those institutions. And Kublai Khan became, in a way, the inheritors of Song China's splendor and profits. But those threats become decisive for the longer term and for these institutions if it causes a change of interpretation of how the world works and how societies work. And often in times of crisis, it turns minds inwards. It creates this kind of societal fight or flight instinct when we want to pick a fight with scapegoats or foreigners, other countries, trade wars, or hide behind walls, behind strong men, behind tariff barriers. So often that external shock is the decisive factor that gives the upper hand to the forces of closed within.
All right. Thank you very much, Johan. I thought about asking you sort of a fun question to put you on the spot a little bit. Who was first, COVID-19 or Donald Trump?
When we look at the legacy of Donald Trump, if he is gone tomorrow, or we're starting the process of sort of dragging him out of the White House, the result might be, at least if we look at US polls, that Americans are more sympathetic to immigration and to international trade than they've been since the start of polling, basically. So there's this, when you see that something is threatened, you rally around it and create a new sense that this, we cannot take this for granted. And it, I think it's created a sense of urgency among US trading partners as well, is that free trade will not be upheld by the US in the long run. We have to do something about it. So in the long run, Donald Trump might actually have a positive effect on openness. I might come to regret those words 2 days from now. We'll see. I think the pandemic has stands a larger risk of changing minds, turning them inwards, and creating this fear of others and the rest of the world. So I'd say COVID-19.
All right. Thank you very much, Johan. And also, let me again plug this fantastic book, Open, The Story of Human Progress, which should be on all your desks or tables. And as I said, it's the perfect Christmas gift as well when you're planning your Christmas shopping soon. So thank you all for joining this Zoom event. And thank you in particular to you, Johan. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation, as always, with you. So thank you very much. And to each and every one of you, I hope you will join us for other events coming up. Thank you, and bye-bye.
Thank you.